being or to experience life here. But it does reject the fact that we have to accept materialism as valuable in itself. It is valuable only to the degree that it stimulates us to outgrow it. Consequently, the life in Zen must have its own order and its own interests and its own activities. What Zen would try to do is to give man a new life, a life in this world in which he makes use of the world but never abuses it, that he enjoys it but never attempts to control it, that he appreciates it without ever attempting to impose his own will upon it. Zen is based upon man's obedience to the natural laws of existence around him. Zen affirms that nature itself is all-sufficient and is a magnificent source of inspiration, of attainment, of beauty, of truth and insight. Therefore, that man is not here to change the world, but to change himself. He is not here to rule the world or conquer the world. He is here to establish his own principles in himself, that he may become capable of living a good life wherever he is, in this world or anywhere else. Recognizing, as Zen must recognize, that man has two existences, one in this world and one as a citizen of eternity. The Zen thinker declares his allegiance to be with eternity, that as long as eternity is in time and in condition and value infinitely more than the material world in which he lives, allegiance to it is infinitely wiser than allegiance to the transitory, inconsistent, unsubstantial situation with which most persons make up their time. So Zen does not say, however, I'm going to walk out of the world, because Zen believes definitely that eternity and time are in the same place. The quiet life lived peacefully is a life in eternity, even though it is lived here. The individual who no longer creates discord experiences the peace of the universe while embodied in the mortal flesh. So the purpose is to make a new adjustment with eternal values, an adjustment which is no longer tension-ridden, an adjustment which is based upon a much more constructive attitude toward other people, and it's an adjustment which inspires rather than irritates those around us. I think then that for a Western man, the problem is a very simple one. Taste is actually man hurrying towards his own end. Why should we be in such a hurry? Why should we try desperately to make time pass? Why should we fill in every moment of it so that we will not notice that there is such a thing as time? Why should we kill time and forget that while we are doing it, time is killing us? Why is it that so many people are locked in a struggle against time? What to do with the 10 minutes, which is going to be a burden unless we waste it? Why should we desperately take medication so that we will not be aware of time? Why should we try to sleep 24 hours a day, as some neurotics do, because they cannot even face the ordinary existences of a day? Why is it that this very precious, this very valuable thing, this allotment of existence that we have here, should be to so many persons a deadly enemy, so much an enemy that they will even commit suicide to dispose of their time allotment forever? At least they think so. Why should we be so desperately afraid of the 60 minutes that make up an hour and hope desperately that they will pass faster so that actually we will die the sooner? The only possible answer to that is that the person in himself has no good use to make of that time. What he wants to do is to work part of it so that he will not notice that it has passed. Then he wants to watch the ball game or the television or go out so that he will suddenly discover that he's been away from the house for 4 hours without realizing it. This is an achievement. Because he wanted to get rid of those 4 hours. He was afraid of them. Zen says that if all you can think of in connection with time is how quickly you can get rid of it, then there must be a terrible poverty in yourself. Because actually time is life. Time is opportunity. Time is privilege. Time is a span of sharing and giving and thinking and dreaming and hoping and fearing, and these things we do not dare to face. If we relax, then, we threaten ourselves with eternal boredom. We threaten ourselves with the condition of having nothing to do. Here is man, the noblest of the creatures, who has spent thousands of years trying to grow up from some prehistoric ancestor to the point where he is the noblest of all creatures, and he is afraid of a half hour because he has nothing to do with it. Something has to be desperately amiss in this type of a pattern. And what it should tell everyone is that they have failed to mature themselves. They have failed to create inner life. And to create inner life is to create something within yourself that is with you all the time and makes existence not only pleasant but significant, every moment of it. It makes you perhaps a little begrudge the hours of sleep because they take you from experiences that are so worthwhile. To achieve this inner maturity of attitude, the Oriental turns to creative art, to creative thought, to poetry, to literature, to all the beautiful things that make up contemplative existence. He finds a wonderful wealth in the contemplative life. The life of contemplation is simply the life of constant acceptances. It is the accepting into self of the wonder of living, the wonder of life. It is to be forever enthralled by universal beauty, to be constantly almost overwhelmed, as the mystic was, by the significance of life itself. In this there is simply no time, no opportunity, no need for all the self-pities and all the irritations and arguments with which we load our lives. But to do this, we must some way escape from the mediocre, from the constant patterns of meaninglessness, which have closed in around us and made every day like every other day. We can break this pattern if we want to. But to want to is the problem. We get tired, we get exhausted with things, we get bored. We give up. Zen tells us if we do this giving up long enough, then the exterior things move in upon us, creating this terrible tension, creating this conflict with life, and gradually interfering with the basic functions of the body itself, so that we shorten life and destroy the very consciousness that we are seeking to perfect. In the Zen way, we have such things as the tea ceremony, which in the West is a complete waste of time. We have flower arrangement. We have the exquisite poetry of the East, the great literature, We have the wonderful writing and painting. We have all kinds of quiet means of enjoying existence. Means that give much time for thoughtfulness. The Eastern tea ceremony reminds the mature, cultured person of the magnificent privilege of sharing some small fragment of life with friends. Over here, friends are people who can do us some good. Friends are people whom we hope we can borrow from, and more still, hope will not borrow from us. This has nothing to do with friendship at all. It's merely a convenience and has brought friendship to a low ebb with Western man. Friends are the other selves with which we share our dreams. Friends are those who respect our silences. Friends are those whose thoughts reach out and mingle with ours across some quiet bridge of meditation. Friends are one soul in several bodies. Most of all, they are fellow journeyers toward eternal peace. And their contributions are the contributions of gentleness, of appreciation, and of kindness. We can have friends without stress and without tension, but only if there is some deep meaning to life. We find, therefore, the eternal need for the building of code, for the building of meaning. And if we cannot find this meaning any other way, we have to build it in ourselves. And if at first we have to choose our friends from the stars, or from the flowers of the fields, or from the birds, we must find those friends with whom we have sympathy of soul. We have to also find expression in some great creativeness. It may be simple, but it must be a tribute. Our tribute to life is creativeness. And we create through fulfilling. And we fulfill life by meeting all of its reasonable demands without tension. We take various areas of beauty and we perfect them. It is the same in raising children. Today, children are a great problem to themselves and to their parents, and their parents are problems to them. But actually, one of the reasons why is that parents and children have had no training, no discipline in values. How many parents today can take the Zen attitude that parenthood is a magnificent voluntary liberation through the complete fulfillment of the highest moral code of parental conduct and character? That the individual who helps his child to unfold is a far happier, wiser, better person than the individual who is trying to unfold himself. We don't realize this. We do not realize that the great release from tension is release from conscious dedication to ourselves. That is why in Zen, everything is, in a sense, away from the personal. The friends gather not that each may preserve his own identity, but that each may be lost in the common good of the group, that each will become Zen-like, completely detached from self, thus forming a new unit, a magnificent over-unit, probably the only democracy we will ever know. It's a democracy of persons united without desire for personal advantage. So everywhere your Zen brings releases from these pressured problems. Releases through fulfillment and not through evasion. Releases by removing the energies which are used to evade with, to bring about this very great quietude of things. Now, there's one other point that I think that in the early days, Zen mingled with Confucianism and Shintoism to produce another, a very, very interesting fact in human experience. Somehow, the greatest perfection of things is uncalculated. The individual, some way, becomes greater than himself when he no longer tries to be himself. If the person simply ceases to impose his own personal feelings upon values, he suddenly achieves virtue. Virtue is therefore the natural fulfillment of things by their own natures. And man is forever interfering by his thoughts and emotions, which distort rather than fulfill. So Zen, producing as it does a complete letting down, we will say, restores a childlikeness in the person, a condition of complete relaxation in which decision is almost certain to be correct. Not because it is thought through by the ponderousness of philosophic decision, but because any decision arrived at in almost absolute quiet will be the best decision of which the individual is capable. Man's decisions are best when he ceases influencing himself. If, therefore, the whole consciousness in its impersonality moves in upon a decision, that decision is well made. But when emotion and thought move in, with their qualifying and modifying attitudes, then the decision is less correct. If in Zen, therefore, we have complete composure, if we have the individuals day by day interfering less and less with the natural functions of his own integrities, there must come the time when ceasing to make mistakes by the use of thought and emotion, the person comes very close to virtue. For virtue is the way of things, the way of heaven, the Chinese call it. Virtue is the inevitable law of things, moving things according to its own purpose and its own will. And when man ceases to move himself and gives up trying to move other people, he is then moved by heaven. It is hard to us for us to understand this, because we have always been striving so desperately to over-influence, to dominate, and to force, to control, and to almost imprison or restrict the rights of others. But when we relax, heaven knows best. The person who allows his complete integration to move him is best moved. And his complete integration means that no single part of him dominates the rest. He must have no allegiances to anything except quietude, except peace, and except the laws and principles which are at the source of life. Zen tells us that in the complete composure and detachment of inner tranquility, even the simplest peasant, the farmer, becomes the sage. That the child becomes the teacher of the man. And that some small flower without voice becomes the teacher of teachers. Everything becomes meaningful if the individual is quiet, follows the ancient admonition, be still, and know that I am God. So against tension, as we know it today, is stillness. And actually, tension is the parent of ignorance, and stillness is the parent of wisdom. For it is only in stillness that we can receive. And it is only by receiving into us, into ourselves, the infinite life of things as a vast motion, as a great energy, that we can ever transcend the small intellectualisms that we try to pass off for knowledge. So tension really locks us away from knowledge, and we can see that in our present world conditions. As tension increases, collective judgment is impaired. In the tension of the last 25 or 50 years, our educational institutions have lost most of the name of action. In the desperate efforts to solve the problems which we have created by ignorance, we find even more ignorant solutions, and the problems get worse instead of better. Everything arising from desperation adds to the desperateness of the situation. We see around ourselves today nervous wrecks making laws, laws that are likely to make nervous wrecks of the rest of us, if we permit them to. Out of this tremendous emergency, out of the futility that is arising in us, out of the disillusionments and the discouragements, out of the loss of our natural buoyancies, out of the loss of our sense of sufficiency and security and problems, comes nothing but more trouble. We cannot, in a state of tension, ever solve our difficulties. For all we can possibly do is make emergency measures, and these are always inclined to make the problem worse. Today we look around, no one seems to have any answers. Everyone is as tired as we are, and out of the desperate conclaves of desperate persons come these measures that lead from one emergency to a worse one. It is the same in personal living. The individual under tension can practically never be right. Whatever his decisions are poorer than they should be. And therefore, out of tension, the individual is constantly adding to his own responsibilities and burdens. He is making life more difficult as he tries to find desperate cures for it. And among the desperate cures that we are looking for is this strange irresponsibility, which is so noticeable in the present generation. Having no answers, these younger people are simply following the pattern of trying to use up life as quickly as possible, lest it slips away unused. This is no answer. Tension cannot relieve itself. The only thing it can do is destroy us and perhaps cast us out of life. We'll come back at some later time and maybe learn then. The only answer is to start immediately to depress this tension or to decrease it. Otherwise, we can never outwit the mistakes which tension causes. If, however, instead of this, we allow the quietudes in us to come through, if we allow ourselves to have a certain amount of stillness, we then become observers of things as they are. Tension is an astigmatism to the eyes. It distorts the testimony of every sensory perception. Tension prevents us from being able to read the truth in the newspaper, in the acts of other persons, in world events, or in the affairs of our own families. Well, the tense person cannot even recognize the facts because he has distorted his own receptive faculties. What we need, really, is the ability to recognize the truth in things, simple truths in daily things, more advanced truths in those rarer episodes that make up various phases of living. To discover truth, we have to relax. We have to get ourselves and our own opinions out of the way. We have to realize that we owe a greater obligation to truth than we do a loyalty to our own attitudes. In the effort to be consistent, We are only perpetuating our own mistakes. If we are unable or unwilling to face the tensions that we have, we can pause for a moment and try to find out why we feel this way. Are we adequate? Are we really enjoying life as much as possible in the sense of peaceful growth? Are our interests greater than our prejudices in all things? Are we more inclined to be kind than we are to be critical? Are we quick to see the good in others and slow to see their faults? Are we actually looking for good? Or looking for faults. If we're looking for faults, then we cannot really learn much anywhere because we have destroyed the honesty of our sensory perceptions. We have to clean house on this. Get rid of habits. Get rid of prejudices. Get rid of attitudes by which you lock yourself into false perspectives. If one by one you get rid of all these various false attitudes, you are almost certainly going to end up in a state of relaxation. You are going to find in the end that when you get rid of all that is false, a very nice life is what is left. A very pleasant, happy existence. When you stop punishing yourself, the punishment ends. For you are doing it. And the moment you stop punishing yourself, and they're quiet, and receptive, and cheerful, you open the gates of vision. You become aware, keenly, of the universe of great joy. And you begin to see past these things. Someone will say, well, how can you see a universe of great joy at the present time? Well, the universe of great joy is there just as it always was. The only difficulty is that human beings have simply refused to keep the rules of the game. The universe is not to blame. And man, by the wonder of the universe, is going to inevitably, ultimately redeem himself. Nothing is really wrong. The only thing that could be wrong would be to have the world as it is enjoy peace. This would prove that there is no justice. This would prove that there is nothing to hope for. Because if a world locked in its own errors can escape those errors without the correction of the cause, then we have no orderly universe. We have nothing to hope for. Our great hope is the justice that will forever decree that the wrong can never succeed. This is our real basic hope, and this is why the universe is a very good universe, even though it looks a little difficult at the moment. It is good because it is going to make us good. And it is good because at no moment in the history of this world, at any time in the past, now, or any time in the future, can any situation arise which will prevent the individual waking up when his own inner life begins to mature. There will never be a time when man cannot find inner peace. And why, by so doing, find the key to the universal confusion and perhaps make his own contribution to the correction of it. So I think we have to very definitely assume the basic correctness of the Zen point of view. That by means of it, we do not build a barrier between us and life, nor do we attempt to escape our own faults and let other people suffer. Nor do we try to save our own lives at the expense of anyone else. What we are distinctly and definitely trying to do is to fulfill the purpose for which we were created. And that purpose is to understand the laws of our own creation and obey them. And to realize that to the degree that we grow up ourselves, we become powerful constructive forces in the complete program. If, therefore, in the course of your daily experiences, you find that you are nervous, the things are getting you, that the tendency to be critical is increasing due to the fatigue in yourself, then you have to realize that you must either accept this and be fatigued and finally exhausted and finally destroyed by your own mechanism, or else recognize that this is a symptom of maladjustment, that you are out of harmony with life. And 9 times out of 10 today, the individual who is out of harmony with life is out of harmony because of his own self-centeredness. That he is trying to get something for himself at the expense of life. He is trying to get happiness without giving any. He's trying to get satisfaction without really sharing. He wants friends without being a friend. He wants adulation, but he wants to criticize others. All these things represent very un-Zen-like attitudes. But beyond and underneath them is this wonderful fact, this absolute integrity of things, which is our hope of glory at all times. This fact is the way in which cause and effect operates. That all these relationships are karmic, and that the only way to get the new attitudes is to create the causes of them in our daily living. So for the person who is under stress, if this stress is of outside things and you see no remedy for it at the moment, not having probably yet a sufficiently deep understanding of the total plan of things, then the first and most natural step is to conserve all possible energy so that you will have as much as you can have for the very important things that you feel you must do. Stop wasting on things which have no real significance. Lower your emotional tension so that your energies will extend over your responsibilities more adequately. Learn to watch every moment against the waste of energies. Learn to automatically protect yourself against any excessive action or attitude. The moment you feel you're temporizing, quietly relax it before it has a chance to arise. Buddha gives a very good little formula for this, and of course Zen is Buddhism. Buddha says, the moment you feel the slightest tendency to irritation against anyone or anything, relax completely. Drop it, even before it has taken any appreciable shape in your mind. The moment you find yourself hurrying, trying desperately to achieve something that may be too complicated, drop it, relax instantly. The moment you observe an attachment becoming unreasonable, don't wait until it has its full fruit of disaster. Drop it. And when I mean drop it, I do not mean that he believed that the individual should give up noble things, beautiful things, fine things, but only things which of themselves prove they are wrong because they disturb rather than ennoble life. A love that enriches is one thing. A love that disturbs is another. A love that impels to unselfishness is one thing. A love which only impels to gratification of desire is another thing. Wherever it is right, it has no tension. Wherever it is tense, there's something wrong with it. So Buddha pointed out, don't wait until you're angry at the man. The moment you sense anger, the moment you say to yourself, I think I'm not going to like this chap, stop it. Break the tension. The moment you see yourself getting tighter at the wheel and your hands holding the steering post too hard, get off the freeway. Drop it. Don't allow yourself to be killed by dropping the wheel in the middle of the freeway. But get away from the situation. Make some change so the tension will break. Never keep letting it mount. You listen to an individual, he's saying things you don't disagree with, and you're getting more and more worked up every moment. Relax. Drop the controversy. Laugh. Smile. Take it easy. Think of something else. If it becomes unendurable, quietly withdraw. But do not allow the tension to mount. If you find some intemperance in yourself gradually sneaking up on you, the moment it presents a difficulty which you cannot immediately handle, drop it. Never let these things build. Watch yourself on politics. The moment you begin losing sleep or losing friends over politics, drop the thing. Think things through, learn the lessons, but never let tensions build. And never for a moment feel that you have the right to prevent other people from thinking according to their own light. But wherever anything disturbs composure, stop it. It is the only way to prevent these things from building. And if you prevent them from building, if you cut them off at the beginning, they will never get to the point where they will endanger you. That is the Zen meditation concept. Because meditation is simply this state of mind or of consciousness in which the individual simply does not participate in excess of anything, but holds all things in quietude within himself. Quietude permits us to think. It permits us to analyze. It permits us to weigh and to truly understand. But when we find it beginning to cause us to pass too many judgments, then be careful. For as soon as we begin to think that we have right to pass judgment on every other individual, an egotistic tension is arising, and we must drop it. Always watching. Until it becomes instinctive. It isn't much of a problem, really, because we know these tensions. We don't have to sit and try to find one with a microscope. We know when we're going to get angry. We feel it coming in. We know when we're irritated and disturbed. We know when the doorbell rings at the inconvenient moment. We know when the cross word is to be spoken. We know when we're going to belittle someone else. We know these things. But before they have a chance to rise within us, stop them. Relax away from them. Never let them reach maturity. Never let them reach the state of confusion. And if we can achieve this relaxation, we will then find that we can face the future with a great deal better hope. And as a reward for this dropping of self-attitude, we will probably become authorities in many other subjects. For the great student of humanity, the analyst, the news commentator, everyone who wishes to have a truly profound knowledge of facts must drop prejudice, must drop all things by which he obscures his own vision of the principles. Failure to do this means that he will have false judgment. So tension arises from all these pressures in ourselves, arises from all these judgments that we try to make, and the offenses that other people cause in us when they do not agree with our judgment. If we can quietly reduce the tensions, then our judgments improve, our lives are happier, and we have more energy for essentials. For it is in those moments when, having dropped these tensions, we are quiet for a moment, that we are at our best. And insight, inspiration, illumination, the mystical experiences, the at-one-ment, the cosmic consciousness, which has been talked about so much by metaphysicians down through the years. All of these exalted states, as Emanuel Swedenborg clearly pointed out, must come to the individual who has found a great internal peace with God. The individual who is to receive the light of heaven must be open to it, must be relaxed and receptive. For if he is full of worldly wisdom, there is no place in him for the wisdom of God. If he is full of himself, there is no place in him for the divine. And if he is completely cluttered with his own tensions, he can scarcely be expected to experience within himself the peace of universal understanding. So as a reward for getting over ourselves, we come close to realities. And this closeness to reality frees us from tension and pressure. Because when we are close to reality, we are sufficient to our needs. And when we are sufficient to our needs, there is no desperation left in us. And we are not striving for anything which requires tension. We are seeking only that which is to be found in quietude, in peace, and in insight. In these arrangements of our patterns, therefore, we come at last to the goal we seek. So our whole problem is to cure, so to say, the tensions in ourselves by means of which we can never come to know what is good in life, or what is real in life, and by which we perpetuate sickness and sorrow for ourselves. If we can understand this, I think we can see why Zen has been so cultivated in Asia, and why it is beginning to deeply interest Western psychologists. For it is the only answer that we have by which the individual can clear his own consciousness by relaxing away from error. Not by fighting it, but by relaxing from it. By allowing error to go to sleep. And when it goes to sleep, that which remains is truth. For error is a cloud upon the face of truth. And if the cloud is dispelled, the truth is there. And behind all the clouds of error will be the light of truth. And the light of truth comes to us when we relax and remove the clouds of tension, pressure, and opinion with which we benight ourselves. If we can achieve these ends, we will have gained a great deal of good for ourselves and those who love us and those around us. Well, our time is up, so we thank you very much for being with us this evening.